Okay, Boker Tov, Erev Tov, Tzaraim Tovim. I don't know, maybe in Australia it's the middle of the night if anybody's here from Australia. We do get people from Australia. We do occasionally get people who come in the middle of the night. So Baruch Hashem, Torah is 24/7. And I want to thank Rachel for today, of course, is the conclusion of her series. And on the Exodus, the Inches of Freedom, today we're talking about the Haggadah and Shemot. And I really want to thank her for your inspiring teaching. And, you know, it's a pleasure to have you. And we look forward to learning with you again in the future. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody at Torah Motion. We will have two more classes before Pesach. Like we said, 24, we don't do 24/7, but we try to do seven at least or 6 days a week. So tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolow will finish his series on how Tanakh evolved. That will be tomorrow at 8 p.m. If you haven't come, you can come to the last class, you get schar almost for all of them, you know, that. And then my follow-up class from the Haggadah yesterday, we're looking back and forth. Anyway, it's the only time that really works for me, and I like it anyways, is on Friday morning at 9 a.m. So I know it's Erev Pesach, but what better things to do on Erev Pesach than to learn a little bit about the Haggadah. So that'll be 9 a.m. instead of our regular class on the Siddur, that'll be 9 a.m. I understand those who can't make it, can make it, whatever, but that'll be our next two shiurim. Please go out in the next couple hours. We'll be sending out an email with all our spring series of shiurim beginning Monday, April 25th. So be on the lookout for that. I think we have a wonderful series of classes, and we hope you'll join. And as I always say, almost as important is please invite a friend. Everybody's responsible. That's the price of admission, is to invite a friend to join us. And hopefully they'll come one and come all. Okay. Want to wish everybody, if I don't see you before, I want to wish everybody Chag Sameach. And we should hear good news. Pesach is the month of Geula. We should hear should merit the blessings of peace and all good things. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry for the long introduction, but Rachel, it's all yours. Thank you very much. Be well.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. And thank you, everybody who's here for our grand finale of the course, where we tie it all together and figure out what, if anything, does any of what we discuss have to do with the Haggadah. And before we delve into the Haggadah, I want to just look back a little bit at everything we saw. When we started this course, we really started at the beginning of the book of Names, the beginning of Shemot, right? At the beginning of the book of Exodus. And we saw the following. I'm just going to open the source sheet. Excuse me for a second. I'm here at box one. And we started with the following words. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each coming with his household: Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Judah. And then we saw how with Joseph's death and the death of the memory of Joseph in the hearts of the Egyptians, the Israelites lose two things. First of all, they lose their names. We hear the following: Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly so that the land was filled with them. Instead of talking about people with names, with identities, we're talking about this group of Bnei Israel, the sons of Israel in Hebrew, not Israelites, but the sons of Israel that no longer have any particular names and are described in terms that make them sound almost like animals, like the animals that God blessed to fill, to multiply and increase and fill the earth in Genesis 1. Only after they lose their identity, only after they become this animalistic force, do we see them also losing their liberty. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the land." And as we discussed in a later class, rise from the land might, as we traditionally understand, mean fight against us, or leave and therefore take away valuable workforce. And then the Egyptians, following Pharaoh's injunction, set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built garrison cities for Pharaoh, Pitom, and Ramses. And we mentioned in one of our classes that Ramses, and we think that this Pharaoh is Ramses III, means the child of Ra, the child of a god. The kings of Egypt presented themselves as the children of God. And we will watch how a man named Moshe, which comes from the same word, the same Egyptian word, Moses, which means son of, child of, or child, rises to represent a totally different worldview, where it's not one man who is somehow blessed by the God that becomes blessed and has divine right to rule over everybody and render all the people around him oppressed to his regime and poor and sick and uncared for in the name of his power and his monopoly on the status quo, but rather every person, every child has a dignity that should be respected, has the image of God. So we saw them losing their names. We saw them losing their liberty. We saw Moshe rising to represent a rival perspective on the world. We saw God propping up Moshe with the plagues. We saw the people starting to take a part in the process when they put the blood on their doors before the last makkah, before the last plague, and then throwing themselves into the sea after the Egyptians chase after them. And we saw how from that process, the process of gaining their liberty, they're then going to Mount Sinai and in a difficult, complicated road, replete with wars with Amalek and receiving manna from the sky, etc., where they're about to regain that first thing that they lost, not merely freedom, but also a sense of identity, a sense of who they are and what's their mission in the world. This is a great story. It's such a great story that it inspired not merely generations upon generations of Jews, but also many other people in the historically, especially people who were oppressed, enslaved, suffering. The story of the Exodus was on the banner of the civil rights movement in America. It was popular in slave songs in the South. It is bandied about whenever national liberation movements start fighting for their rights. It's ingrained in the American identity or definition of self as a revolutionary, freedom-oriented nation. It's always been there as the platform or the symbol of freedom. And you might think that when we sit together once a year, ready to celebrate this great story of freedom and pass it on to our children, that we would tell it in the way that it's told in the Exodus. Start by telling what we lost, go on by telling how bad it was in Egypt, telling the story of the plagues, of Moshe, of all those things that we discussed in the past 9 weeks. But this is not what we do at all. Instead, we start the Seder, and I'm not talking about the Seder, sorry, but we start the Magid, the part of the Seder where we actually tell the story, where we say, Lehagid, the story, with the following words. Ha lachma anya, diachlu avatna be'ara de Mitzrayim. This is the bread of destitution that our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. This in and of itself still sounds as if we're about to tell the story, right? We're picking up the bread, the matzah, and we're saying, this is the bread of destitution that our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. It sounds like now we're about to say, and this is how they got to the land of Egypt, and this is how they were destitute there, and this is how come we're not there anymore. But instead of staying there in the story of the past, the storytellers of the Haggadah, the compilers of the Haggadah, force us to drag our attention away from the story and into the present. Because we follow by saying, anyone who is famished should come and eat. Anyone who is in need should come and partake of the Pesach sacrifice. It's a rather odd declaration of hospitality. What's odd about it is its timing. Because at this point, people are already seated around their tables. It's not likely that there are people still roaming the street looking for a spot for Seder and that they will hear us saying that and bang on the door and walk in. I mean, maybe it happened to you. It never happened to me. I've never seen someone say these words and then actually welcome somebody into their house. It's almost a ritualistic declaration of openness and hospitality. But at the same time, kind of makes us wonder. It forces us to take a step back and say, wait a minute, why are we saying that? What do we mean by that? Instead of losing ourselves in this story, in this great story of liberation, we find ourselves wondering what's going on. And then, in case we're not confused enough, come the following words. Now we are here. Next year, we will be in the land of Israel. We're no longer talking about our forefathers and their destitution in Egypt. Now we're talking about ourselves. And we say, this year, we are slaves. Next year, we will be free people. Once again, forcing ourselves, unless we just read it without paying attention, but forcing ourselves on some level of our consciousness to say, wait a minute, are we slaves? Aren't we talking about that slavery from a long time ago? Why are we saying that we're slaves now? Are we play acting? Is this an improv class? Is this theater? Later in the Haggadah, we will hear that in every generation, a man, I insert, a woman, should see herself or himself as if they themselves came out of Egypt. We will get there later in the Haggadah. It's like towards the end of the text of the Maggid. But okay, is that what we're doing here? Are we play acting as if we came out of Egypt? Or are we talking about some level of slavery that's actually true for us where we are now? In other words, instead of letting us immerse ourselves in the story of the Exodus as we saw, as we could immerse ourselves easily in the chapters of Sefer Shmot, where we have a dramatic story with a horrific villain and a grand hero and the darkest hour before dawn and then the break of dawn and then the breathless chase and the need to throw yourself into the sea. It's all perfect. It's such an immersive, powerful story. Instead of allowing us to go there and actually talk about it, already at this very short text, at the very beginning of Maggid, we're forced to grapple with stories about who we are, what we are, where are we in relation to this story, what does it mean to us, and how are we supposed to grapple with it? What are we supposed to make of it all? In what way do we mean it when we say we are slaves, we are here, next year we will be in Israel, next year we will be free? And the Haggadah goes on to continue in that line. Instead of letting us enjoy ourselves, instead of letting us talk about the story of Egypt, it goes from this enigmatic declaration of intent to, famously, the four questions, where, again, instead of focusing, I'm in box four of the source sheet. Rabbi, do we have it uploaded in the comments? Okay, thank you. So in box four of the source sheet, you can see the famous questions. What differentiates this night from all the other nights? And again, instead of talking about the past, we're pointing out the differences in the present. And then it looks as if we are finally ready to start telling the story. We're saying the following piece, which is in box five. We were slaves to Paro in the land of Egypt, and the Lord our God took us out from there with a strong head and an outstretched forearm. And then we're saying, and if the Holy One, blessed be He, had not taken our ancestors from Egypt, behold, we and our children and our children's children would all be enslaved to Paro in Egypt. And even if we were all sages, all discerning, all elders, all knowledgeable about the Torah, it would be a commandment upon us to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And anyone who adds and spends extra time in telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt, behold, he is praiseworthy. Okay, great. When we finish a passage saying, and anyone who adds and spends extra time telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt, behold, he is praiseworthy. What do we expect to follow? Feel free to unmute yourself and say it out loud.
The story.
The story, right? We're just saying, it's good to tell the story. Do we tell the story? No. Instead, we're going to talk about other people telling the story. We talk about how it happened once on Pesach with Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon were reclining in Bnei Brak and were telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt that whole night until their students came and said to them, the time of reciting the morning of Shema had arrived. Now, the truth is that there is a clear connection between this passage and the one that preceded it. If we stop for a second, we can see that in a sense, it's almost an illustration of a particular sentence from the previous passage where we say, and even if we're all sages, all discerning, all elders, all knowledgeable, etc., it would be commanded upon us to tell the story of the Exodus. So it's almost as if this story illustrates this point, because we have these great rabbis who are clearly far more knowledgeable than we can hope to be, and yet they talk at such length that their students need to come and intervene and remind them that daytime has broken. The day is upon them and it's time to move on. Okay, so fine. We illustrated the point. Now are we going to get to the story? No. Instead, we're moving to a different story that kind of goes into a tangent from the fact that the rabbi spoke through the night. Because we hear that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, "Behold, I am like a man of 70 years, and I have not merited to understand why the Exodus from Egypt should be said at night, until Ben Zama explicated it, as it is stated in Deuteronomy, in order that you remember the day of your going out from the land of Egypt, all the days of your life." The emphasis here is the word all, kol in Hebrew. The days of your life without the all indicates that the remembrance be invoked during the days. All the days of your life indicates that the remembrance be invoked also during the nights. So that explains to us why the rabbis were sitting at night. Except then, the rabbis, the other sages, not Ben Zama, a different group of rabbis, introduce a different opinion. They say, no. The days of your life indicates that the remembrance be invoked in this world. All the days of your life is not adding anything about the time of the day when you read about the story of the part of Exodus. What it indicates is that the remembrance be invoked also in the days of the Messiah. In other words, even when the world is redeemed and everything is perfect, we will have to remember the story of the Exodus. It will still have meaning to us, even if everything is great and liberty, the world is at liberty and at peace and at meaning and identity is restored, etc., etc. The story doesn't lose its place in the world. All of which is very interesting from an intellectual perspective, and it's very interesting for anybody who's interested in understanding how the sages thought, and if you know about the different sages and their history, it becomes very interesting to try and understand what kind of interpretive philosophy they're invoking when they make different opinions known. But what has it to do with the story of the Exodus? Aren't we gathered here around the table to talk about coming out of Egypt? Aren't we gathered here to fulfill what Moses told us on the eve of liberation, as we discussed a few weeks ago, when he told us one day your sons will ask you, why are you doing all these things on Passover? And v'higadet alevincha, and you shall tell your son, you shall tell your children about this moment of liberation from Egypt, and you will pass on the story. We're not doing any of that. Instead, at this point in Agada, we go into a discussion of pedagogy. We talk about the four sons, the wicked son, the wise son, the naive, innocent, simple son, and the son who doesn't know how to ask and how to handle each of them. And then when we finally get to the point that is really the reason for our getting together, the story of the Exodus, we don't just tell the story. No. Instead, we take the way the story is recounted in Deuteronomy, in a place where Moses tells us what to say when we bring the bikurim, the first fruits to the temple. Moses, on the eve of his death, gives us instructions. He tells us when you go to bring the first fruits, you should say the following text, and we will read it in a bit fully. And then the text of the Haggadah takes that, breaks it into verses, and matches between the verses in Deuteronomy and parts of the story in Exodus. I'll bring an example, just a moment. I'm going to go forward to box number nine. In Deuteronomy, it says, when you enter the land that your God is giving you as a heritage and you possess it and settle in it, you shall take some of every first fruit of the soil which you harvest from the land that your God is giving you, put it in a basket and go to the place where your God will choose to establish the divine name. You shall go to the priest in charge at the time and say to him, and here comes the words, I acknowledge this day before your God that I have entered the land that God swore to our fathers to assign us. The priest takes the basket and raises it, and then you recite the following. I'm jumping a little ahead. My father was a fugitive Aramean, Arami Oved Avi. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. And then we keep talking. We say, but there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to Hashem, the God of our ancestors, and Hashem heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. Hashem freed us from Egypt, by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, an awesome power, and by signs and portents, bringing us to this place and giving us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Therefore, I now bring the first fruits and soil, which you, Hashem, have given me. This group of verses actually tells us the story of the Exodus with admirable brevity and excellent storytelling technique. It goes straight to tell us about going into Egypt, about how bad it was there, how God heard us and saved us, and how look at us today. We are here in freedom and we have the fruits of our land. It takes the entirety, in a sense, of not only the book of Exodus, but also Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Yehoshua, and sums them up for us, putting the emphasis on what's important, which is it was bad, God saved us, God gave us things, we rejoice. All the important bits are here in order. If we would just quote this text and the Haggadah, we would get the point. We would get the point of the story. We would get the experience of sharing the story of what happened to us. But instead of doing that, we keep breaking it apart. We say, go out and learn what Lavan the Aramean sought to do to Yaakov, our fathers. And then I'm skipping a little bit ahead. I know, since Paro only decreed the death sentence on the males, but Lavan sought to uproot the whole people. And then from that, we start explaining what this means by quoting the text we just read in Deuteronomy. As it is stated in Deuteronomy, an Aramean was... wandering Aramean is my father, I'm going by the other translation, and he went down to Egypt and he resided there with small number and he became there a nation great, powerful, and numerous. And now, instead of going on with this story, we start breaking it apart. And he went down to Egypt, helpless on account of the word which God told Abraham that his descendants will have to go into exile. And we quote Genesis. And then we keep going down the text from Deuteronomy, saying a word from it and matching it to parts from the Exodus narrative with verses. I'm sorry if I'm rushing. I'm gonna reframe it now. In other words, what we're doing, first, we only get to the story as it is told in Deuteronomy in order to explain why Lavan was worse than Paro. That Paro only killed the boys and let the girls live, while Lavan wanted to assimilate all of us into himself. Then once we actually get to the text in Deuteronomy, instead of just reading it or bringing it in its entirety, we break it and keep comparing it to other bits and pieces from Genesis and Exodus. The overall effect of which is that when we read it, we don't feel like we're hearing a story. We're feeling more like we're hearing exercise in hermeneutics, more like we're reading a page of the Talmud where the sages are trying to match different pieces and bits and create their own meaning map that should guide our actions, but that is not based on the internal logic of storytelling, of how a story has a beginning and a middle and an end. They have no respect for that. They take bits from here, bits from there, mix it all up and say, oh, look, this means something. As an adult, especially if we're inclined to be interested in interpretation, again, it can be very interesting. Just that it can be very interesting to try and understand why the story of the five rabbis appears there and why we need to know about the difference of opinion between Ben Zoma and the rabbis when they say what it means to study the story of the Exodus all the days of your life. It's all very interesting. But in what way is it serving the story? In what way is it giving us that feeling of we were enslaved and now we're liberated? and we're thankful for it, which is the core message that we're supposed to somehow pass on from generation to generation to generation. If anything, to be honest, it makes that role difficult. Because, let's be real, when we're sitting around the Seder table with young children, and they see all these weird stories are not giving them a sense of what happened in Egypt. These weird stories are giving them a headache and a backlash. And I still remember the first year that my son was old enough not just to sit at the table, but really participate. And I remember we went through the Maggid and we discussed every text. And at the end, he gave me this look and he said, "But where is the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim?" And I'm like, "Oh, we just mentioned, we just talked about it." And he's like, "No, we didn't." Somehow the story seems to be bled out of the text. And the question I want to pose for us to grapple with and to really think about is why? Why did the authors or compilers, really the Agadah was created and recreated over many generations, already from the times of the Mishnah until deep into time of the Gemara, and even after the time of the Gemara, the first millennia of the Common Era, throughout the first millennia of the Common Era, why did the people who compiled it choose to compile it in this way? If the idea was to make us feel as if we come out of Egypt, why not give us a story with a story arc, with a beginning and a middle and an end? Why not give us characters to root for? So much of human engagement with stories happens on the level of empathy to protagonists. If you think about any story that moved you or meant something to you as a child, many of them work, if you think, what was it about them that was so compelling? In 9 out of 10 cases, I'm making generalizations here, but it's pretty clear that in 9 out of 10 cases or so, it's because the characters were relatable for us. There was some character that we cared about. It's very hard to care about a story where the characters are utterly unlikable or utterly alien to us, whose experience is just so out of our experience. The way we relate to story is through empathy. And it's hard to empathize. Sorry. Excuse me. It's hard to empathize if there isn't a character that we can understand, that we can relate to, that we can identify, that we can at least recognize as somehow of the same realm of human emotion and experience as us, even if it's, you know, a superhero in some imaginary world, has friendships, has weaknesses, etc., all these things that we deal with in our lives. The Exodus story gives us an excellent protagonist. It gives us Moshe. Who cannot care when we follow Moshe from the moment when he's a baby and we see how his mother and his sister and the daughter of Paro come together out of compassion, out of love, out of sisterhood to bring him into adulthood in a world that wants to kill him, where he shouldn't exist? We already care. And how can we not care when we watch him grow up and the first thing he does is come out to see the suffering of his brothers? And not only does he see it, he then acts upon it and kills the oppressing, the Egyptian who's beating the Jew. How can we not care about Moshe when we then watch him time and time again see things and act upon the moral imperative inherent in every situation? When he sees two Jews fighting, he tries to intervene. When he sees Midianite shepherdesses being abused, he intervenes. When he sees a burning bush, he steps off the path to see what happens. And later, time and time again, we see him dealing and grappling with a mission that's difficult for him, that he doesn't want to accept, that he doesn't feel well suited for, and yet he overcomes. And not only does he carry the people out of Egypt, he then turns around, as we discussed last week, and represents their case, their cause to God when God develops an enmity towards them after the sin of the golden calf. How can we not care about this character? And yet, there's exactly one place when Moshe is mentioned in the Haggadah. Does anybody know where it is? Does anybody recall? Exactly. Several of you said it correctly. There's this bizarre, forgive me for my liberal usage of adjectives about this, but it is bizarre in a sense, argument between the rabbis in which they're trying to outdo themselves. Each of them is trying to explain that not only was the miracle at the sea so much more impressive than the miracles of the plagues in Egypt, but they're trying to make it count as more and more and more. They're saying, oh, if there are 10 plagues in Egypt, right, then there are 50 on the sea, because we heard that in Egypt they saw the finger of God, and in the sea they saw the hand of God. And then they say, oh, no, no, in Egypt they had 50. So really it's 250 on the sea. And they just, it's almost like a bizarre one-upmanship competition that combines numerology and hermeneutics. And within that context, when they try, the first rabbi, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's Rabbi Yosei HaGlili, when he tries to explain that there are 10 plagues in Egypt and 50 plagues on the sea, he said, and he talks about how on the sea it says that they saw the hand of Moshe, the hand of God. He says, and he quotes there, "V'yaminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo," and then they came to believe God and Moshe his slave. So the one place that Moshe, that wonderful character, that wonderful protagonist, that relatable person who could have made us delve into the story so easily and so compellingly, the one time he's mentioned is in an offhand quotation that's meant to prove something totally different. And he's mentioned as God's slave, not as our savior, not as the leader of our coming out of Egypt. It's as if he's totally pushed aside. Why? Why not give us a story arc? Why not give us a character to root for or relate to, if you will? Why tell the story in this broken up, jarring, fragmentary way that doesn't allow us to lose ourselves in it and to really be inspired by it, but rather forces us to constantly ask, wait, what? Wait, how does that fit in? Why are we looking at that? Why, instead of quoting one passage that actually sums up the story, the passage from Deuteronomy, does the story of the Haggadah, does the text of the Haggadah break even that one text that we finally do get, break it apart into this exercise in hermeneutics by matching verses from Deuteronomy to verses from the Exodus? What are the authors trying to achieve? Why aren't they letting us tell the story? I want to share a small vignette just to emphasize it. 2 years ago, we were still in Boston, and it was the first Pesach of the quarantine, of the pandemic. And my son, who was 2.5 years old at the time, was very enamored with the story of baby Moses on the river. I think it's a pretty classic story for young children to be enamored by, partly because it's very compelling and partly because it's very easy to do arts and crafts projects about it. So kindergarten teachers of all generations really delve into this story and make a lot of to do with it. It's a little bit harder to do arts and craft projects about Makat Bechorot, for example, at least ones that don't traumatize the children. And it was quarantine, so he didn't go to kindergarten, but his kindergarten teacher was wonderful, and she sent us videos about baby Moses, and she gave us little baggies with materials, and we made a beautiful project with a baby that my son then took with him to the bathtub and put it there so it will float amongst the imaginary reeds. And then I sat down to learn with my children before Pesach to prepare them. And I told them, let's prepare our own Haggadah. We can't be with our family this year. So let's prepare a Haggadah and share it with our family so they will see your work, your hard work, your ideas, etc. which part of the Haggadah do you want to paint? All my children, without fail, said, we want to paint baby Moses. And I said, but baby Moses is not in the Haggadah. Do you know where he is in the Haggadah? I asked as a rhetorical question. And my 2.5-year-old immediately said, yes, he's in the bathtub. And that was that. But the reason I'm sharing it, beyond the fact that it's a very cute story and I love my children and it's fun for me to remember their antiques, is that it illustrates the gap between what we expect the story to tell us and what the story actually tells us when we actually engage with it on Pesach. In order to start answering the question why the text does it, why the text is so choppy, so meandering, so consistent in its refusal to give us the, you know, what we might call best practices of storytelling, a clear story arc, a chronological timeline, a character we can care about, etc., I want to share with you a personal experience. I want to share with you my experience growing up hearing my parents' story about their struggle to leave the Soviet Union. I was born, as some of you probably heard me discuss before, I was born into a moment of victory. My father, Natan Sharansky, was in Soviet Gulag for 9 years, while my mother was traveling around the world, marching, advocating for him and for Soviet Jewry in general, marching in demonstrations, organizing events, mobilizing people, meeting world leaders. And the pressure that world Jewry exerted consistently, heroically, passionately, devotedly, was so great that eventually the Soviet authorities folded. And in 1986, they let my father go, and a few years later, the Iron Wall fell. And I was born a year, or not even a full year, after my father came home and was reunited with my mother. And I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't know their story. There was not a time like that. Because wherever we went, people would say, oh, you're the daughter of Natan Levital Sharansky. You know, when your mother came to lead a demonstration in, now fill in the blank, Toronto, London, Australia, Paris, Phil, whatever, she slept on our couch. And I have to tell you that there was a time when I imagine, and some of you probably heard me share that story before, but there was a time when I really imagined that my mother must have slept on all the couches in the world. And I kind of imagined the struggle for Soviet Jewry as this march of couches, marching single file and slamming against the iron wall until they brought it all down. I did outgrow this image, perhaps a little sadly, because it was a pleasant image to have, but I did grow up surrounded by this feeling that somehow my parents' story was the story of the entire Jewish people. Beyond that, my parents themselves always shared the story, and not just all the time, but also on the day of my father's liberation, on the anniversary of my father's liberation, ever since the first year after he was liberated, my parents would hold a family seder of sorts. It would be like Pesach. We would set the table with the best dishes. We would dress in our holiday clothes. My father would wear a kippah that he only wears twice a year. It's a kippah that a fellow inmate in prison made for him from the filling of a boot, that fabric that you wear when you're in very, very cold temperatures. It used to be, it's not exactly a sock. There's socks, and then there's just a like a wrap that you put around your foot in the prison before you put it in the boot. So a fellow inmate used that to make a kippah for my father, and my father wears it twice a year for Pesach and on his liberation day. And we would sit around the table, and my sister and I would ask questions. And the questions differed. When we were very little, the main question we wanted to know the answer to is, were there any animals in prison? Later, we started asking about diet in prison, what kind of food you had, what did you do with your time? When we were teenagers, we were really interested in my parents' love story. How did you meet? How did your love survive those 12 years when my mother was in freedom in Israel and my father was in the Soviet Union and later in the gulag itself, etc., etc. Then when we became young adults, young professionals, young mothers, we were very preoccupied with the question of how do you go from fighting for your people, be it in solitary confinement or in traveling in the world, to normal life, to changing diapers and finding a job. How do you translate the existence of years and years of sacrificing and devoting everything for a cause to just, you know, the realities of adulthood? How do you make the move without feeling that everything pales by comparison or that everything is meaningless? And so on and forth. And the consequence of growing up with all these questions and answers and with this intense feeling that the Jewish people are part of our family story and we are part of a Jewish people's story was that even though I was not alive for the actual struggle for Soviet Jewry, I always felt as if I was, as if it was my story. It became part of my own internal landscape to the point that, for example, if I had a frustrating time a few years ago, I had a frustrating time when I felt I couldn't reach any of my goals, I naturally turned to techniques that my father used in prison to uphold his, you know, stamina in the face of oppression, to uphold my own state of mind, which is a little bit of an overkill, right? Using the techniques that he had to use in solitary confinement. But that was just normal. That's my story. That's my toolbox. That's what I know. And when we took our young children, when they were a year old, our firstborns were a year old, we went to Moscow for the first time to see the places where the struggle took place, the places where this demonstration took place, and that demonstration where my parents met and where my father was arrested, and the prison, we didn't see it from the inside, just from the outside, the prison where he was interrogated. And when we saw all these places, it was this bizarre experience of seeing a place that's entirely new and yet is entirely familiar and feels as if you've seen it many, many times before. As our children grew, we were very excited to pass the story on to them. After all, the story was so meaningful to me and so powerful, so inspiring for shaping my own narrative of myself that I wanted to give this gift to my children. And we included them. Once they were toddlers and no longer one-year-olds, we set them around the table with us on my father's Liberation Day. And we're very excited, I think even more excited than my father, actually, in a sense, to include them, to pass the story on to them. And they had no idea what to ask. So I said, okay, let me tell you the short version of the story, and then you can ask questions. And I said, there used to be evil people who didn't let Saba come to Israel. And we made all the kids go under the table, and the adults surrounded the table and wouldn't let them come. So Safta, so I said, started going around the world and saying, let Saba go to the land of Israel. Saba, grandpa. Yeah. And my mom would go around the room and start yelling it. And I said, okay, but nobody listened to her. So she went to all the Jews of the world and asked them to yell with her. And because we're all brothers and sisters, and we are avim ze laze, we're responsible for one another, they did. And then all the adults in the room started yelling together, let Saba, grandpa, go to the land of Israel. And I said, until it was so loud that the evil people had to let him go. At this point, we opened the human chain around the table and let the children victoriously leave their horrible solitary confinement under the table. And Saba came to the land of Israel and was reunited with Safta, and everybody met him in the airport and sang, Inam atogu manayim, shevet achim gam yachad. Great. And my kids loved that. They all clapped. They rolled on the floor laughing. And they said, now tell us the story of Aladdin. And that really set the pattern. Because the more exciting I made the story for them, the more I poured into it everything I know about storytelling, be it making the lows lower and the highs higher, be it offering them more personal color, more of the personal details of my parents' childhood for them to relate to, stepping the story on a cliffhanger, everything I know about how to tell a story so it'll be compelling and exciting. The more I poured myself into that project, the more eager they were, the more happy they were to hear it, but also the more eager to then move on to another story. Somehow what for me was this foundational part of my own life, for them was an exciting, beautiful story that they cherished and then would just place on the shelf in between Frozen and Snow White and ask me for something else. And I was very distressed by it. It felt both like a failure as a mother and a failure as a storyteller. And storytelling is my job. That's what I do. I explore storytelling both on both ends, as a scholar of storyteller and as a storyteller myself. And then I carried this frustration with me 1 year from our family Seder to the real Seder, to the Passover Seder, which is a month and a half later. And suddenly it was as if a light went off in my mind. And I said, wait a minute, the authors of the Seder had to deal with the same problem I'm dealing with now. They had to take a story that happened to other people and make it relevant and compelling for a new generation. In fact, they had a much harder task because their story that they had to pass on was not of our grandparents. It was of some random people millennia ago that we barely can understand because their life was so very different from our own. Let's see how they did it. And that was when I noticed what I shared with you today, namely that they did it by not bothering with any of the storytelling best practices that I tried to emulate. Everything that I did that tried to make the story more immersive, more compelling, more interesting, they just ignore. Instead of an arc, they give us a mishmash. Instead of a clear storyline, they give us fragments and jumps and hermeneutical discussions. Instead of characters to root for, they consistently remove the one character that really, more than any other, represents the story of the Exodus to us, except of that one throwaway comment in the context of the argument about the plagues and the sea. And I, looking at that, I realized that this was exactly what my parents did too, because my parents didn't give us the story of their lives. They invited us to ask questions. The questions came from where we are in our own lives. When, as children, we were most interested in animals, so it was questions about animals. Then we were teenagers interested in romance. It was questions about romance. And we were young adults interested in how to handle the realities of adulthood. So that became the source of our questions or the inspiration for what we wanted to know. And then my parents gave us their answers, and they, again, didn't give us polished, perfect answers, the kinds that can fit in a fairy tale. They gave us truths. They gave us bits and pieces. They gave us anecdotes and memories and ideas, broken parts of a whole. They did, in other words, they didn't try to gift us their personal understanding and narrative of their lives, even though they would if we asked them to. But the first thing they gave us, the most basic thing they gave us, was bits and pieces that we could then use as building blocks, not to recreate their story of themselves, but to use as we created the story of who we are in our own lives. This is what made my parents' story so foundational to me, so embroiled or interwoven into my way of dealing with depression, frustration, life challenges, etc. If all I had was this shining model out there, I don't know that I would have been able to translate it into day-to-day decisions in my own life. And once I understood that, I went back to the Haggadah and I realized that while the Haggadah isn't giving us a transportive story, in storytelling we talk about the transportive qualities of a story, that a good story is a story that transports us elsewhere. It makes us forget the world around us and go elsewhere, be it Hogwarts or the Death Star or Jane Austen's world of Regency England, wherever it is you want to go. The Haggadah doesn't transport us. Instead, it forces us to confront and engage with the bits and pieces of the story in our own lives. It makes us ask, in what way are we inviting whoever is hungry to eat with us? In what way are we slaves? What does it mean that we are sitting here reading about other people telling the story in Bnei Brak in the Roman era instead of telling it ourselves? How does it place us? Are we following in their footsteps? Are we their students? In the story, are we the rabbis who talk about the story? Or are we the students interrupting them, telling them, no, the real world needs you now. You can't keep talking about the story. Who are we in that moment? When we read that long hermeneutical text that takes those bits and pieces from Deuteronomy and mixes and matches them, or matches them, more to the point, with pieces from the Exodus, are we interpreters? Are we detectives trying to put the pieces together? Are we part of the tradition of the sages? Are we taking ownership over the texts by playing around with them? Who are we in that moment? When we read about the four sons, when we see how the rabbis think that we shouldn't tell the story in one way to every child, but rather find the way that fits the needs and the temperament of every person at our table, what do we make of it? Do we then just keep reading, or do we look around our table and try and wonder, how does this person whom I love and sits at my table needs me to talk to them? And how does that person needs me to talk to them? And can I do both at once? And all of a sudden, we're no longer just, you know, engaging with a story out there. And instead, we're engaging with our relationships right here. And we bring the story into them, into the context of the intimate connections between us and the people around our table. And sorry. When we finish, when we say, in every generation, a man must see himself as if he himself came out of Egypt, are we just readers reading it? Or did we actually go through some process that made us understand better how we can see ourselves as if we came out of Egypt? In other words, the story that we learn together in the Exodus gives us a shining model. It gives us almost a treatise about what freedom is. And we talked about so many types of freedom. We talked about freedom from oppression, but also freedom from forgetfulness. And we talked about freedom from fear a lot. We talked about that a lot. And freedom from the system, the oppressive system that warps morality and makes you think about everything in terms of the good of the state instead of right and wrong universally. And it's all very important to engage with. But on that night that we sit together, we're not talking theoretically. And we're not visiting a story that explores these ideas. Instead, we are constantly forced to engage with the broken pieces of that story, because what we're supposed to engage with is with who and what we are in that moment, and where do we fit into that story. And that's a story, that's an engagement that we can no longer just close as we close the book of Exodus and put it on the shelf, or as we close a fairy tale and put it on the shelf and move on to something else, because that's something that changes who we are. And I want to finish this with this one idea, with this one last idea. In the book of Exodus, we explore different meanings of what it is to be free, what it is to liberate yourself. This is why I call it the course, the ins and out of freedom. But the storytelling of the Haggadah invites us to experience a sort of freedom instead of thinking about it in a theoretical kind of way. It invites us to experience the freedom of authorship, because we are not spectators and we are not a passive audience. Instead, we are people who are actively engaged with the text, that we're constantly challenged to examine in terms of our lives, our relationship with our children and parents, our understanding of who we are right now, our understanding of in what ways we are enslaved or liberated, or want to be more liberated than we are right now. And out of all of that, we create the narrative of who we are at the moment. And it's hard. We can't really experience what it was for the Jews, for the Israelites to leave Egypt. We can't. Our lives are too different. And most of us, at least, are lucky enough now to live in freedom, in political freedom, at least. And I know that I myself, well, my father experienced what it is to come out of an oppressive regime. I did not. I was born, and I had the tremendous fortune to be born in the land of Israel in a free world. in a free world in a free time. But while we can't experience what they experience, we can experience a variation on the theme of moving from being an oppressed group of slaves who doesn't get to call the shots, who doesn't get to tell its own story, who can only groan because they don't even have the words to express their suffering, to a people who are invited by God not only to stand as his partners in Mount Sinai, as accepting his suzerainty over us as royalty ourselves, as we discussed last week, but rather also, or 2 weeks ago, but rather also then to go to the land of Israel and build a society where we express the values and ideas that God gifted us, where we create the anti-Egypt, the land where the laws are the law that are based on the fact that we knew what it is to be the stranger and the oppressed, and we are not going to reproduce that in our country, in our lives. This taste of liberation as empowerment, as becoming from the objects of other people's storytelling to our own storytellers, a variation on that is what we're gifted by the storytelling of the Haggadah if we really engage with it. We're gifted with that feeling of what it is to step out of passivity, out of spectatorship, out of being an audience, and becoming the storytellers of our own story, of our own selves, of our own being. And this is how the storytellers of the Haggadah take the book of Exodus and make it into something more, make it into something that we can recreate time and time again, and it's different every time. And more than that, it's ours. On that note, I want to thank you all. It was wonderful to explore these ideas with you. I have one final idea, but I'll take some of your questions here. Just a minute, I'm going to go into the chat. Just a minute. iPad, sorry, I don't know your name, wrote, wasn't the original plan to be in Israel, Canaan, Jerusalem as metaphor next year? Correct. That in the moment of the Exodus, the idea was that within the year, they're already going to be in the land of Israel. I assume that you're writing that in relation to the fact that we're saying this year we are here, next year we're in Jerusalem, this year we are slaves, next year we are free, which in a sense means that when we say these words in the beginning, halach ma'anya, we are putting ourselves very much in the shoes of that first generation, but I think it only strengthens the kind of challenging nature of this text, or the way this text invites us to think or to question things, because we already know, looking back, that that didn't happen, right? We already know that this hope of this year we are here, next year we're in Israel, is not actually what took place. So in what way are we like them? In what way are we not like them? What does it mean that this hope didn't happen? It's all questions that are evoked by this text. Just a minute. Bob Davis Baltimore wrote, it seems a shame to me that the state of Israel has not lived up to the theme of freedom for all people. I would say the following. I know it's a controversial thing to say, and somebody already wrote, who has lived up to those lofty goals? I would say the following, I would relate to it from two perspectives. One is American history and one is Judaism. In American historiography, historians doing American history, there's been a divide in the recent two decades. And this is actually my field. Actually, what I studied in my MA was historiography and history of American history specifically. Older generation of historians kind of take the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the checks and balances of power and celebrate them as something new, a new chapter in history, which it is. There's no question that it is a new chapter in history, where suddenly there's no divine right of ruler, but rather the right comes from the fact that the people who all have inalienable rights and I'll get to that in a second, give power to their rulers. In the past few decades, there's been growing criticism of this position, saying, okay, Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, was a slave owner. When he said all men are created equal, he obviously did not mean all men are created equal, and note that there's no women here at all mentioned. So how can you celebrate that to that degree? And there's really a struggle between two schools of thought in historiography of, can you talk about the greatness of the founding fathers, etc., or is it just whitewashing over their oppression and the hypocrisy of talking about freedom and inalienable rights while keeping certain populations repressed in some terrible ways? So there's a middle way offered by some historians, which I think is relevant for engaging with the question that was raised here, that says, instead of looking at the Declaration of Independence as good or evil, let's look at it as the beginning of a process. The power of this declaration, of this idea, was so powerful that it kept changing reality past the expectations and intentions of its authors. Its authors may have meant all men are created equal in a limited sense, but once the idea was out there, it was powerful enough to inspire an expansion of liberties to more and more people and with greater and greater equality over the next 200 years. I think that this position, I find it very compelling for various reasons. And I think that it's worthwhile adopting it also when we look at what it means to be Jewish. Every place in the world, every country, every society that tried to be a city upon a hill ever, always to some extent failed to live up to its expectations. Because we all see the world in terms of our understanding of it. So we have whatever horizons we see. Freedom goes as far as we imagine within the horizons of what we see. But then if we expand freedom, if we expand justice, if we expand goodness, our children will view the same question from a different position. Their horizons will already extend further than wherever it is we can see. And in a sense, it's actually very similar to what I said about the way stories should pass from generation to generation. As long as I tried to control the narrative for my children, it didn't pass. Once I let it go and I just answered their questions instead of giving them the polished version of the story as I saw it, as it meant something to me, once I passed them their pieces, they could take it and create their own stories. And it was hard. It's hard for me because I think I got the right version of the story. The version of the story that I believe in, that I live by, is very meaningful and empowering to me. So I want them to have that. But that's not what they need. And I need to let go of the story. Like, you know, my parents fought, let my people go. Moshe fought, let my people go. I need to let the story go. So in the same way, a society tries to reach a better place, and then the children of that society will see a better, even better way to live up to their ideals. And their children will see an even better way to live up to their ideals. So I don't think that Israel failed to live up to this ideal. I think that Israel is a work in progress, just like humanity is a work in progress. And we should not be complacent, and we should always ask ourselves how we can be more than what we are right now, and in what way can we be next year more free and make the world more free than we are right now, since after all, we are saying every year, this year we are slaves, next year we are free, right? So in some way, I need to be able to next year look back and see, oh, I made the world better this year, right? So every year when we say that, I think we should ask ourselves what we can do more. But we should not do it from a place of harsh judgment of all our failures, but rather from a place of, in what way can we continue? In what way is this an ongoing story in what way is it an ongoing story that we can, and here is really where I think most important emphasis should lie, create together. And on that note, thank you everybody for being part of learning our stories with me in this course. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And I wish all of us a happy Pesach, a transformative Pesach, a meaningful Pesach, and may we all individually and collectively make the world and ourselves freer from this year to the next and so forth. And on that note, have a wonderful Chag. Chag Kasher.
Thank you so much. Are we going to get the story? You had mentioned you were going to add something. You had said you'll read our questions and then add something possible.
Actually, I incorporated that.
Oh, you incorporated. Okay. I just didn't. It's so enjoyable. I didn't want to miss anything. Thank you again.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
No, but I meant just to share with you how letting go of the story helped my kids create their own. So it's and the questions always
reached. Thanks, Amel. Have a wonderful time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.